I want to talk about Hakuin. How many of you know who Hakuin was?
Okay.
No disquisition? Well, he was wonderful, and I commend him to you. He was a Japanese teacher who lived not super long ago. Compared to Dzogchen and Dogen and the guy I've been talking with about at SBMG, who died in 806. So Hakuin's dates are 1686 to 1768. And he's kind of known as, do you know what Rinzai Zen, does anybody not know what Rinzai Zen is? Okay, good. You're brave, good for you. Rinzai, nowadays there are roughly two schools of Zen Buddhism in Japan. There's Soto, which is ours, which is the dumb farmer school. And there's Rinzai, which is the one where they work with koans. And this is probably Rinzai person would punch me in the nose for this. I don't know. They strive for enlightenment through understanding and working with koans, teaching stories, and often start with Mu, which is the no or not or emptiness, whatever you want to say. And sometimes we say that the difference is that if there's a peach ripening at the top of a tree, they would climb the tree to grab it, whereas we would sit at the bottom of the tree and wait for the peach to fall. And don't go to any of your Rinzai friends and say you understand what Rinzai is based on what I just said, please. And they don't, and we use the word koan sometimes to mean like a contradiction or a sort of a difficulty in an apparent contradiction in your life. You know, that's the koan of my life right now or something like that. They hate that. I've been told that by friends that they hate it. Those two people don't like it. I don't know about all Rinzai people. At any rate, Hakuin was a very great teacher, and he is thought of as the one who revived Rinzai practice in Japan. And he lived at a very small temple not very far from our home temple where Suzuki Roshi was born and raised. Rinsoin, it's called. It's in I don't know how small it is. I haven't been there in a long time. At any rate, it's a town. It looked to me sort of like Stockton. I haven't been to Stockton in a while either, so. But at any rate, it's like that. You know, a city, but a small city. I could say it looks like Vallejo, probably. At any rate, Rinsoin itself is up on a hillside, and it's very beautiful. And Hakuin's temple is near there. When I went to Rinsoin with Blanche many years ago with it for a practice period for women, we did a day trip on a day off. We were taken to Hakuin's temple. So it wasn't that far. It's called Shoinji. It's also not far from Mount Fuji. Hakuin was born into kind of an upscale innkeeping family, and that's how he grew up. And he got interested in practice because his mother, I think it was, it took him to a lecture by a priest from a different school called Nichiren. Those are it's not Soka Gakkai, it's not SGI. SGI is a branch split from them. Nichiren is the original, but they also chant Namu Myoho Renge Kyo, right? Anyway, this priest gave a lecture about how if you didn't, I guess, practice sincerely and diligently, you would wind up in the hell realm, and then proceeded to give a terrifying description of hell. Hakuin was really scared, and he he couldn't let it go, and he wound up getting ordained because he thought, well, that way, if I'm practicing as a priest, then I won't go to hell. And that was his motivation. And after he'd been a priest for a while and he was around other priests, he learned, I hate to say it, he learned that priests could also succumb to the temptations that lead to hell. So then he was in real trouble. And he wound up meeting his root teacher, Shoju. And Shoju asked him, why did you become a monk? And he said, for fear of falling into hell. And Shoju said, you're a self-centered rascal, aren't you? And from Shoju, he came to understand how practice is what's central, and being useful is what's central. And Shoju really emphasized, as did Dogen earlier, that enlightenment is not the be-all and the end-all, that the point is you just keep practicing. You just keep being useful. You just keep being a bodhisattva. And Shoju really emphasized that too. The books say that he emphasized post-satori practice. And eventually, Hakuin came to understand that it didn't work to practice in order to avoid something. You know, there are various stories about that kind of thing. And people practice, you know, sometimes we say don't have a gaining idea, don't practice in order to get something. But it's exactly the same problem to practice in order to avoid something. Right? Just do it. And he always was, well, I'm going to come back to that. I don't want to go too fast. Hakuin had a great awakening, a satori, I guess, when he was 41. And he understood the mind of enlightenment, to practice to be of use to others, to be a bodhisattva. So that was his enlightenment experience. Or maybe I should say this, that it was his understanding of his enlightenment experience. You know, because we have an experience, and then after it happens, this happens, I can't snap my fingers anymore. This is a loss. I hurt my elbow, and this is one of the consequences of I can't snap my fingers. Anyhow, now I forgot. So in my self-regard. Oh, you have the experience. And immediately after that, you separate from it and you point back at it and you say, that's what happened. Right? Because you can't know, cognize your experience until you separate from it and label it. Right? So, and that's normal. You don't have a choice about it. You know, if you might have the experience, but you'd never know that you had the experience. No, in the sort of normal sense. You wouldn't know you had it until you separate from it enough to be able to look back and say, oh, that was da dee da doo. Does this make sense? Mm-hmm. At least you understand the words. I mean, and so that's why I say that he understood his enlightenment experience to be really understanding that the mind of enlightenment is the mind of a bodhisattva, the mind of being useful to all beings, something like that. And that's where his life really turned. And he became a great teacher, and he taught lots and lots and lots of students. And He's a wonderful, if you Google him, you'll see lots of pictures. He was a great artist, and he was also a great calligrapher. And he wrote a wonderful poem, which you can, I'm sure, find Google, because this is very common. It's called Song of Zazen. And if I had it handy, I'd read it to you, but I don't have it handy. But you could go get my iPhone out of my purse and Google it. Daniel,
are you looking?
I'm looking right at you, yes.
No, it was Song of Zazen.
Song of Zazen. And it's short. And he also loved the Lotus Sutra. Oh, you won't be able to open it. Ugh. This is a new one, and now they just make you jump through all these hoops in order to just be able to work your... So, no, don't worry about it. I can do this. Sure. Song of Zazen. Maybe you'll find it faster than I will. You know how to spell Hakuin? I think I got it. Da 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 da. It's on YouTube, of course.
Isn't everyone?
Right. Whoa. Ah. I want to talk about his calling hell a bodhisattva. That's what I want to talk about. But since you don't know him very well, this is a great introduction. Okay. Zazen Wasan, Song of Zazen. All beings by nature are Buddha, as ice by nature is water. Apart from water, there is no ice. Apart from beings, no Buddha. How sad that people ignore the near and search for truth afar, like someone in the midst of water crying out in thirst, like a child of a wealthy home wandering among the poor. Lost on dark paths of ignorance, we wander through the six worlds. From dark path to dark path we wander. When shall we be freed from birth and death? For this Zazen of the Mahayana deserves the highest praise, offerings, precepts, paramitas, and embutsu, at one-ment practice, the many other virtues, all rise within Zazen. Those who try Zazen even once wipe away immeasurable crimes. Where are all the dark paths then? The Pure Land itself is near. Those who hear this truth even once and listen with a grateful heart, treasuring it, revering it, gain blessings without end. Much more if you turn yourself about and confirm your own self-nature, that self-nature is no nature, you are far beyond mere argument. The oneness of cause and effect is clear, not two, not three. The path is put right, with form that is no form, going and coming never astray, with thought that is no thought, singing and dancing are the voice of the law. Boundless and free is the sky of samadhi, bright the full moon of wisdom. Truly, is anything missing now? Nirvana is here before your eyes. This very place is the lotus land. This very body, the Buddha. So it's the Song of Zazen. It's easy to find, unlike the calligraphy of hell, which we were trying to find during the break. He had a lot of students, and he was pretty tough on them. Oh, I forgot to add, if you read about him, you'll find he was funny. Unlike Dogen, you may have noticed. Hakuin was very funny, but he was tough on his students. And he stopped teaching when he said that he couldn't be tough anymore. All he wanted to do was burble love songs to the monks. I'm not there yet. And one of his famous calligraphies is, some of his calligraphies are just, there's a big scroll and it's big dramatic writing. It's not a picture. It's simply calligraphy. And what it says is the Bodhisattva hell. Not the Bodhisattva from hell or the Bodhisattva hell. So I think he turned around his youthful fear of hell and practicing in order to avoid hell, to understand that hell was a great, great teacher. That when we find ourselves in hell, which we do, that if we can practice with it, it's a great teacher. You know, we say often that, you know, we're energized to practice when things are hard. You know, and we're saying to ourselves, like, why? Why me? Or what is this? What is this about? Because when things are going swimmingly, we tend to simply enjoy it. Not too often do we say, you know, why me? But when we're in the hell realm, angry, jealous, fearful, that's when we are almost, if you're a Zen practitioner at any rate, it's almost like you're almost forced to take this finger here and turn it inwardly to illuminate the self and to really explore the nitty-gritty of what's going on. And that's what Hakuin was pointing at with this calligraphy, I believe. And I saw it, and it was very dramatic. When we were at Rinso Inn and we went on our outing, I presume it was planned. One day a year, they, at his home temple, they take all the scrolls out and hang them for a day. And the idea being, to kind of check them over and to dry them out and be sure that they're okay. So we were there that day, and it was quite wonderful. So we saw a lot of them, and that was one that really struck me. And there are pictures of it, I know. And in some his autobiography is called Wild Ivy, and there are books of his writing and so on. It's easy to find Hakuin books, and I really think he's a wonderful person to study. Even it doesn't matter what school he comes from. Just that understanding that hell is the teacher, and when you come at it with a Bodhisattva mind, with this mind of being useful and I want to say, if you can ask me to go explain this more if you want, it, with the mind of letting go into Sangha. I mean, that's a way of talking about what the Jizo ceremony is, that you, with others, you let go into that, and that whatever your grief is, it may be the hell realm. And it may be that it isn't, you know, I don't know that those big, big griefs ever go away, but your relationship with it can change and it may come back. So I don't think you can talk in terms of a kind of healing, but not some, suddenly everything's fine and you never hurt again. You know, when your spouse died, or your child died, or your mother died, or your sister died, or whatever. But that turning towards that hell with that mind, that inquiring, supportive, kindly Bodhisattva mind, is a great practice. I think it is our practice. Not thinking about it, but being willing to sit still and sing the song of Zazen. So do you have any questions or comments or your own experiences or notions of Hakuin or hell? Yeah.
When I hear of Hakuin, I always think of
I always think of Hakuin's well-known painting, Blind Men Crossing a log, I think. And it's very dramatically drawn in just almost stick figure form, but it's I'm always taken by the image of, I think, three or four blind men creeping along, trying to cross, I guess it's a log, across a creek, across a stream. And if you look carefully, the log doesn't quite reach all the way across.
And that's, you know, it's sad and whatever, but it's also funny. And that's how he was, you know, and that's perhaps a reference to us. That's what we are. We're these sort of blind people feeling our way along, and then we're going to die. Is that how you understand it?
That's just, that's well put, I think. We don't actually know what's going to happen when they get to the end. If it's the space between the far bank and the end of the tree could be bridged, but for a blind man, it would be...
Without help. There could be help. And, you know, I mean, one of the ways of understanding Jizo is that Jizo is a bodhisattva from the hell realm. So he's not hell bodhisattva, but he lives in the hell realm. And he helps people in the hell realm. You know, you think of Avalokiteshvara goes down in the hell realm and brings people out. Well, Jizo's there. Jizo lives there. And Jizo is there for all of us all the time. I sometimes give a little Jizo figure to people when they're dying, because it's these particular ones were made by a man named Jack Van Allen, and they're small, but they're also kind of round, and so they feel good to hold. I think John's was cremated with him. I don't know. It's sort of interesting, isn't it? It was so vivid at the time, and it's fading, which is fine. Do you know who I'm talking about? Does everybody know who John Briggs was?
Well, Hakuin has a lot of stories about women. And there's one story about a woman who ran a tea house, and she sort of had a reputation of being really mean, because you could go to the tea house and sup tea, and she could tell whether or not you were just sipping tea, or whether your mind was wandering, or whether you were having discussions about the sutras you'd read the night before, and things like that. And she would like be kind of a rinzai
tea lady, right? A tea lady.
Yeah, that would cut through to, hey, you're not just drinking tea.
So he told the story?
Yes. Uh-huh. He went to the tea house, so he knows that this is how she was. So she was this special bodhisattva.
Yeah. I hope he just drank the tea.
Yeah, me too.
He liked his sake, too.
I have a comment. Is this on?
Yeah.
Bodhisattva hell. And bodhisattva heaven, bodhisattva joy,
mm-hmm.
bodhisattva pain.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like to think that the practice goes from hell to heaven and from pain to joy.
Are you done?
Yes.
I don't think so. I'm so sorry. I think that it might go from hell to heaven, and then it's going to go to the animal realm. And then it might go to the human realm, where sort of we get enough trouble to be willing to practice. I don't think that there is... because there's too many goals in that, I don't think it goes like that, whatever it is. And I think our job is to just be and allow ourselves to open to bodhisattvas. And they're everywhere. And it's open to us to practice as a bodhisattva all the time. And there are in the world, have you ever seen a Tibetan sort of wheel of life, and it's got greed, hate, and delusion in the middle?
Right.
Okay, well, you can't see it. Okay, I'll take your word for it. It looks too complicated. But anyway, in the middle, there's greed, hate, and delusion. There's a pig and a snake and a rooster. And then there are six realms around it, and up the top is these blissful gods. And near them is the sort of jealous gods that aren't in the bliss realm anymore and are trying desperately to get back to it. And then there's the human realm, and the animal realm. Okay, that's four, right? And what am I leaving out? There's the hell. Yeah, but what else?
Hungry ghost.
Hungry ghost. Yes, thank you very much. And and often in the depictions of those realms, there's a little medallion in each one, in each realm, and there's a bodhisattva there, which is a wonderful image that it's always available to us to practice with whatever hell we're in. Because, I mean, you could say in some sense, being a hungry ghost is hellacious. A hungry ghost is somebody who can never be satisfied. And we all spend time there, those days or those times when you just can't. It doesn't matter what anybody says to you or what they do, it's just not enough. Right? Some people spend a lot of time there. Hopefully you don't, but we all spend time there from time to time, right? But there and in the hell realm is a really angry, usually very angry realm, and there's a bodhisattva there. Okay, so I think that our job is to allow our lives to unfold as they do and practice with whatever it is, but without some idea of going somewhere or getting somewhere. And then see what happens. And it sounds maybe, I don't know, nihilistic is quite the word, but not encouraging or not hopeful. But I think it's really the most hopeful thing in the world, to let go of wanting anything. And I fail all the time. We all fail all the time. But that's the bodhisattva, the hell bodhisattva is there, always there for me and for you. You hit the bottom and there it is, support. So, yeah.
About you mentioned Hakuin studied with Soju for a while.
I'm sorry?
Hakuin studied with Soju?
Yes.
Soju. Soju, thank you. One thing I like about that story is, you know, before he visited him, he was at like a lecture retreat, and he kind of skipped the lectures, and he kind of locked himself in a, like a, I think a, it was a mill or something, or a shrine. You know, he went in this deep samadhi, and you know, he felt like he was like frozen in ice. And then the temple bell rang, and you know, the ice collapsed, and you know, he had an enlightenment experience. And he's like, "Oh, amazing! You know, I'm enlightened." And so he went to Soju, and he said, "You know," and Soju said, "You know, what about Mu? And he says, well, there's no, you know, no hands or feet can touch it. And Shoju reached out, pinched his nose and said, you know, my hand has it. And, you know, Haku was like, oh, God. You know, and Shoju kept calling him a hoe-dwelling devil or a cave-dwelling devil. You know, and Hakun couldn't really understand it. And only later in his life when he, you know, had that decisive awakening when he was 41 did he realize that Hakun was trying to tell him that he was trying to hold on, or, you know, he was making an object out of something that was mm-hmm. formless. You know,
he was trying too hard. I mean, he got sick pushing too hard, which is it's possible to do.
Yes, I really like that part of the story.
Yes. You should read this book. This is from Wild Ivy. This is his autobiography. It reminds me of another story, which is a similar, which is, I don't remember where it came, I know where I read it. Dogen writes about it in his instructions to the senior staff at the Monastery de Heiji. And he starts off this long essay with more general points for all the senior staff. And there's one where the Buddha was visiting his, I think it was his nephew or something, and he felt that it was time for his nephew to join the order. And his nephew kind of knew that this was coming, but he wasn't at all, it wasn't clear to him that he was ready. And his wife was upset. It just, you know, this Buddha sort of hanging around so you know what's coming. And he says, I'm just going to go with him for a little while, and I'll be back before your makeup is dry. Which you think back in those days, there was probably a lot of makeup. But at any rate, he goes off with Buddha, throws him in the sleeve of his robe, and they fly off to where the monks are. And he stays there for a while, and then Buddha takes him, and he's practicing, and Buddha takes him to a heavenly realm where there's a beautiful woman, and she's all alone, and there's a place set beside her. And so the nephew says, well, who is that for? And she says, this is for you, darling, if you practice the precepts. And so he's all excited, so they go back, and he's practicing the precepts really hard. And the Buddha tells the other monks to kind of shun him. And he says, there, and they say, why? And Buddha says, he's not really doing our practice. He's practicing in order to get something. He's practicing in order to reach this heavenly realm. And so they all kind of shun him. And finally, he's hurt enough. He goes to the Buddha and says, what? Or maybe to one of the others. He says, what's wrong? And they say, you're practicing for something. You're not practicing just to practice. And he's very upset, and Buddha throws him in his sleeve again, and they go off, and there's this really ugly, ugly person. I don't know if it's even a person or some animal, a lot of hair and ugly, and again with a place beside this being. And he says, what's that? And that's then the animal says, this is for you after you run out of merit for practicing in order to get something. And then he's really scared. And then they go back, and by then he's ready to talk about it and understand that he needs to practice just to practice and not in order to get something. So that's what that reminds me of. I think it's a wonderful story.
That sounds like a Soto Zen story.
It's Dogen wrote it, but I think he was quoting something. Yes, it is a Soto Zen story. Well, Hakuin liked Dogen a lot. He also loved, he didn't understand the Lotus Sutra at the beginning, and then, I don't know if it was when he was in his 40s, it may have been around that time, he reread it, and then he fell in love. Which just makes sense to me. Anything else? No more Hakuin stories? Yeah. One, two. there's a...
So if we find ourselves in a hell realm, we accept, I guess, or we not exactly welcome, but but we don't try to run away, or we don't try to shut it off, I guess, and with the faith that this too, I mean, like there will be something will happen that I don't know will happen, and or there'll be some change. Is that right?
I think so. I mean, it's like that can be tricky if you're expecting, you know, you don't know what's going to happen. But I think if you turn towards it, and very kindly take care of yourself, so that because sometimes you know when something is really hard, you know, you turn towards it for a while, and then you need to be in denial for a while. You need to back off a little ways, and then come back. I mean, our practice, I think, is just like Zazen. You know, when you find yourself, you got on the train of thought, you come back, and you don't beat yourself up about the fact that you were thinking for a while. Mm-hmm. Or you try not to, because it's not useful. So you turn towards it. You keep turning towards it and asking yourself, what is this? And then your job is to stay open to whatever happens or whatever comes up, and to stay with it. And sometimes I think you can be in a position of saying, sort of okay and fooey. You know, like this is all right. I'll do that. I'll do this homework, but I don't have to like it. Oh, I don't have to really I deeply want to do it, but on up here, I don't have to want to do it. But I know enough that about practice and so on that I know I have to do that. I mean, I'm thinking a lot. I mean, for me, this is about grieving my sister. And, you know, sometimes it had sort of faded, and then the anniversary came up not long ago and various things. And so it's come up again. It did. I'm not sure where it is right now, but at any rate, and I had to actually make a decision to, you know, I thought, you know, it's been over a year, so why do I want to cry all the time? And I fought it for a while, and I finally thought, it doesn't matter what you're, some idea that you have, Mary, about what's enough or the right way to grieve and all that crap, just cry. And then I did, and it, you know, it lightened a little bit, and then I did cry, you know, off and on a lot for a week or so. But it was hard to get myself to do it. But I, you know, once I realized, look, you don't even have to figure this out. Maybe it's not about your sister. Who knows? But just do it. So is that?
Yes, I think that you did answer that. I mean, the way I'm taking that is that it does take a measure of having faith, having trust,
yes,
that if you are with it, you know, that, mm-hmm, that is the right place to be, I guess. You don't try to push the river. You don't try to stop the river. You just be there.
Yes. And often things change, but you can't assume that, and you can't. I go to a grief support group, and one of the leaders says sometimes he has quite a charge about it. I think he has some homework to do, which I've told him. But at any rate, you know, there are certain things, like people say, you know, that you will accept your loss, and he'll say, I'm going to shout, so I don't know what's going to do the mic, but he'll say, I loathe that word. Whoa, okay. You know. But I think maybe he feels a little protective of, you know, us as little darlings or something. But at any rate, but it's true. I mean, if you use that word to mean that, you know, if somebody in your family was murdered and the murderer gets executed, you're going to be fine after that because you accept it. No. No. So I think we do better if we just sort of let it happen and see what happens. And often there's some acceptance afterwards, often there's some relief. Darlene used to talk about that. You know, she'd say she knew that a meltdown was coming. One of the many things I liked about her was that she didn't just always say she was la la just because I have rheumatoid arthritis and blah, blah, blah. You know, I'm fine because I'm practicing. No, every so often she'd fall apart and rail against it and so on. And she couldn't stop it. She couldn't make it happen. And she knew that on the other side she often would learn something, but she still resisted it and then eventually kind of had a life of its own and she opened to it and it happened and then whatever. You know, she might learn something. She might just feel exhausted and relieved. I don't know. Anyway, you know, that's the koan of our practice. You know, to have an intention and a direction, but not a goal. It's hard. Thanks. Okay, last one.
Oh, well, I'm just sharing my Hakuin memory. Anyway, one time I came home from a 7-day retreat, and I had a book that's called Hakuin's Commentary on the Heart Sutra, and it's translated by Norman Waddell, if you want to look it up.
Yeah.
And so I read Hakuin's. It's short. It's a short commentary. You can read it in an hour or something like that. And it was a barrel of laughs. It really was. It was. I was really open to Hakuin's acerbic take on the Heart Sutra, and you know, because Heart Sutra presents itself as sort of the ultimate wisdom, right? The ultimate wisdom, and Hakuin just sort of destroys the ultimate wisdom, and it's very refreshing if you're in the right mood. So that's my story.
I want to read that. I don't think I've ever read that. Waddell is his major translator, so you can assume that that'll be a good translation. Okay. I think we should stop unless there's one burning desire. We have about a minute. Okay, thank you. I commend Hakuin to you.